If you're the police, where are your badges?
Badges? We ain't got no badges. We don't need no badges. I don't have to show you any stinking badges.
Forget it, Jake. It's Chinatown.
What we've got here is failure to communicate.
I'm a man. Well, nobody's perfect.
Fasten your seatbelts. It's going to be a bumpy night.
He wins, he takes the car. I win, I take his finger. Is that so strange?
Leiningen, you're up against a monster 20 miles long and 2 miles wide, 40 square miles of agonizing death. You can't stop it.
I'm as mad as hell, and I'm not going to take this anymore.
Round up the usual suspects.
Silent Breed is people!
Wait a minute. Wait a minute. You ain't heard nothing yet.
Welcome to Paleo Cinema Podcast.
Paleo Cinema Podcast is a fortnightly podcast about movies. All kinds of movies. Crime movies, science fiction movies, horror movies, movies with cool actors you've never heard of in them, movies where CGI stands for criminals, girls and ice picks, classic movies, cult movies, and any other movie Terry wants to rant about as long as the movie is more than 20 years old. You can find the podcast website at paleo-cinema.com. The voicemail number is 206-350-5440. Or you can email or send MP3 voicemails to cultguru@gmail.com. That's cult with a K. This podcast usually contains swearing and is probably not safe for work unless you work in a brothel or a David Mamet film.
Hello and welcome to Paleo Cinema Podcast number 93. Yep, we're heading up towards three figures and I am so looking forward to that coming along. My name's Terry Frost and this time we're still doing the A to Z project on Paleo Cinema and we are up to the letter N. So there were lots of things I could have done with N. I was actually looking at doing Ninotchka, but decided not to. Two things really reached out and grabbed me as far as N films are concerned. And in this case, they have been Nightmare Alley, which I have wanted to do on Paleo Cinema for a very long time, with Tyrone Power, arguably his best film, and really a bit of a departure for him at the time. And the other film I wanted to do was Network, which is one of the most prophetic movies about the television industry ever made, and a very influential one as well. If anybody has any interest at all in the politics and the kind of zeitgeist of television, this is one of the films that you really have as a touchstone. It's didactic. There's lots of people shouting in it. There are some fantastic speeches in it. But yes, it is one of the go-to movies for an examination of television. So, anyway, how is everybody? It is 2012, which always sounds incredibly futuristic when people say it. Forget all that shit about the Mayans. It's not going to happen. The world is not going to be destroyed. It can't be destroyed anyway because it's really hard to destroy a planet with any effective technology that we know of. So, 2012, we had a very quiet New Year's Eve. We just stuffed ourselves full of seafood and didn't really do too much as far as New Year's Eve is concerned. Next year, probably do more. We did drive up to Sydney to spend Christmas with my sister, her fiancé, and their little boy, Billy, and my mother, Billy's grandmother. It was great. We hung out in Randwick, for people who know Sydney, not too far from the beaches, Randwick, Maroubra area. I got to have my pie at Harry's Cafe de Wheels down at Woolloomooloo, which is a fantastic pie cart that's been here since World War II, does terrific pies, and everybody who's anybody who visits Sydney goes and has a pie at Harry's. Everybody from back in the early days, Noel Coward, Marlene Dietrich, right down to Chris Hemsworth, who played Thor. Everybody goes there and has a pie, and they have their pictures stuck up around Harry's, and it's just a legendary institution in Sydney foodie area. And every time I visit Sydney, I've got to go down and have a pie at Harry's. And one of the nice things my sister Linda has done is promised me that the first time Billy goes and has a pie at Harry's, I get to take him down there to have that so I can pass it on to the next generation of the family. Silly, but it's really something that means something to me for no really good reason. So things are going pretty well. It's a very kind of damp and humid day today. It's summertime. The weather has come down through the centre of Australia from the tropics, and we've got a little bit of a kind of wet season tropical downpour thing happening at the moment. So if you hear some rain at various times during the podcast, that's the reason why. It's been quite warm. Not as warm as most Christmases and most summers for us, but not too bad anyway. So I'll just get on to what I have been watching. And I have been watching some very interesting things lately. So I'm just opening up the old Mizo and seeing what is there. Before I do that, I should mention that my computer that I normally podcast on totally balked itself. A lot of cement dust got into it at some stage when we were doing the renovations, and the floors were getting ground to level the slab, and it seems to have slowly but surely killed it. So I went out on a limb. I've got a new PC here, which is running very smoothly at this stage, and I do hope it lasts a lot longer than the last one did. But anyway, having said that, let's have a look. I'll scroll down a lot. Sorry, this is fantastic podcasting to do that. Here we go. Let's see. I did see Hunter Prey, which is an interesting, very small science fiction film, which a prisoner and a crew of a transport ship on a very inhospitable planet, and they fight each other. It's kind of like Hell in the Pacific or one of those kind of films done as a science fiction film. And yeah, very low budget, but very interesting, visually very nice. And I recommend that one if people have got a little bit of spare time and want to go into something a bit different as far as science fiction is concerned. You could do a bit worse than doing Hunter Prey. Let's see what else. There's a fair few because basically it's been a little while since I recorded. I recorded early for the last time around. Anyway, there's a movie called Triangle, which is a kind of alternate universe, time warpy, timey-wimey kind of film. It's filmed in Australia with Melissa George in it, but everybody has American accents because they're trying to sell to the American market. Basically, a bunch of people go out on a yacht. The yacht capsizes in a storm, and they go aboard a large ocean liner, which seems to have a time warp in it, and they're attacked by people. They don't know who they are, and there are time loops and paradoxes and all that sort of thing. Low budget, but really interestingly done, and a very gutsy piece of acting by Melissa George, who is an Australian actress, kind of light usually, and doesn't do anything gutsy. She was in the recent adaptation of Krista Solkos' novel The Slap, which was done as a miniseries here in Australia. But if you get a chance, Triangle's not too bad, a little off-the-radar science fiction movie to check out. I did see Mission Impossible Ghost Protocol, which is an interesting film, a good action film, a very, very fine action film, and not to be disregarded for that. But I agree with something somebody else has written about this film, that the character of Ethan Hunt, the character that Tom Cruise plays in this film, is basically a shell of Tom Cruise's cinematic charisma. There's actually no depth to the character. Even though they do try to give it a little depth and a little backstory and a little history and a little humanity, it's essentially an Easter egg shell with nothing inside it. But having said that, it's got Michael Nyquist in it, the guy who was the protagonist in the original trilogy, the Girl and the Dragon Tattoo trilogy of films, and it's nice to see him doing something, even though he's kind of poorly used. Simon Pegg's in it as well. Some very nice action set pieces, and it's nice to see Dubai again. I visited Dubai in 2004, and I'd love to get back there. It's a very interesting city, but the interesting parts aren't those high-rises and the Burj Khalifa and all those things. The interesting places for me were the old souks and the places where people have been trading for 5,000 years, but having said that, check out the film. It's not it's done very well. Brad Bird, the director, did a lot of animation for Pixar, and quite an interesting little exercise. Let me just take a look at what else. I just paused there to scull my espresso because I really wanted to. I did see an Australian film from the 1970s called The F.J. Holden, which is a kind of slice of life in the less privileged suburbs of Sydney and around Bankstown in the 1970s. It's about a guy called Kevin who works at a motor mechanic shop and owns an old F.J. Holden. And it's basically his life, his social life. He meets a girl. They get on okay. They're together. Him and his mate Bob hang out in the car. They drag race. They get in trouble with the cops a bit. It's kind of almost pseudo-documentary at the time and done mostly with non-professional actors. But I kind of like the F.J. Holden because I grew up in that area at that time, for one thing, and really it's, you know, an interesting time and place and a kind of nostalgia fest for me. So it's a, in that sense, it's a personal film when I watch it for myself, but it's all part of the exploitation wave of the 1970s when people could actually get funding for Australian films and did interesting projects. So nice to see that. It was actually on cable, and it's not often you get older Australian films on Australian cable. There are lots of packages they buy in from the US mostly, and also the UK. But the F.J. Holden was on Fox Classics, so I really enjoyed watching that. I did rewatch Hannah, the movie which has Saoirse Ronan in it and Eric Banner and Cate Blanchett. Nice action film. Interesting to see the action scenes in an action movie done without the quick editing, which I kind of like. The action scenes do have that kind of gutsy, visceral reality to them. I got it on Blu-ray fairly cheaply. I got given a whole bunch of gift cards from JB Hi-Fi, so that was one of the movies that I bought on Blu-ray. And, yeah, pretty good. New Year's Eve. I did watch one of my great New Year's Eve movies, which, of course, I know Rupert's very fond of, Get Crazy, the Alan Arkush movie with Malcolm McDowell, Daniel Stern, and a bunch of other people in it. Paul Bartel's in it, Mary Warrenov's in it. And it's all about New Year's Eve at a large rock venue, which has got a great history. It's kind of like a Fillmore kind of place, and it's all about the rock stars who turn up there and all the backstage stuff. And Malcolm McDowell plays a character called Reggie Wanker, who's very much a Mick Jagger kind of character. There's drug use in it. I'll be truthful with you about that. But even though from Rupert's interview with Alan Arkush, it isn't totally a success, I think it's a lot of fun. I think it's good-hearted and good-spirited and just transgressive enough and interesting for that reason. And so I thought I'd revisit it. I used to watch it a lot on New Year's Eve back in the 80s when I was hanging out in Canberra and other places like that. So I did revisit Get Crazy and had a bit of fun with it. First movie I saw this year, I thought I'd go a bit classy because it's not normal, it's normally what I do, was Midnight in Paris, the Woody Allen film with our old mate Owen Wilson in it. Yeah, I liked it. I loved the fact, I loved the time travel aspect of it, of course. I love Paris as a city, so I was very much there with that as well. And I do like the fact that the characters and the movie assume that you know a bit about literature and about art, the arts, and that kind of thing when they go in there. They don't spoon feed your knowledge on who Ernest Hemingway or Gertrude Stein or Picasso or Degas or anybody like that is. They assume that you've got a little bit of nous about you. And yeah, and it's a good story. It's there's a slight morality tale to it in a nice, gentle way. It's one of Owen Wilson's least obnoxious roles. Rachel McAdams in it as well, Marion Cotillard, Michael Sheen, Kurt Fuller, Carla Bruni is in it as well. And yeah, it's just it's a love story where Paris is the thing loved almost. And and yeah, I do like it. I think it's one of the better Allen films I've seen lately. And just the establishing shots over the titles where they just basically do postcard shots of Paris is really well done and gives you such a good setting in the city for the story that it really is a lot of fun. And if you haven't seen it, do see it. It's not going to be an action adventure film or anything like that, but I am very fond of it. And I may, in fact, I will get it on Blu-ray when it comes out. I did also see, because then I went down market, of course, I did also see the original Dr. Dolittle with Rex Harrison and Samantha Egger and Anthony Newley in it. Shit, that's long. I do like it. There are certain little bits of it I like, and it's a bit of fun. It's about a doctor that talks to the animals. It's much better than the Eddie Murphy versions, even though it is long. It's got singing and dancing Richard Attenborough in it, amongst other things. It's got a giant sea snail and a giant moth that tries to fly to the moon, and all those kind of cool things they had at the time when marijuana was very popular. So I did watch that. I picked it up very cheaply. I had a couple of bucks left over on one of my gift cards, so I picked it up cheaply on DVD. And not too bad. I also saw FX and FX2, The Deadly Art of Illusion, the action films with Brian Brown and Brian Dennehy in it back from the 1980s. And yeah, they're a little fun. Brian Brown playing a special effects expert who gets involved with government agencies and criminals and action and all that kind of thing. And they're a bit of fun. There's nothing at all offensive, and they don't seem to have dated as much as a lot of the action films from the 1980s are. And they're very intelligent too. The way that they use the fact that the guy is a special effects artist to push through and for him to kind of MacGyver his way through the problems that come up when he's being shot at or chased, or when his girlfriend gets shot by a sniper and all that kind of stuff, are quite good. And Brian Brown's a good, solid actor. And in these kind of action roles, he was very good at the time. He's now gone on, he's doing much more producing and things like that with his wife, Rachel Ward. But they were on TV, so I checked them out when I was just vegetating a little bit. I did rewatch The Fifth Element as well, because Sal and I have got a running joke about multipass. And it's a good action film. I love the Jean-Paul Gaultier costumes. I love the kind of dynamic action. I like the future world that they set up in The Fifth Element, which is a lot cooler than a lot of other future worlds I've seen. A little gritty. It's got texture to it, which I like. I like the fact that you can get fast food from a flying Chinese junk, and all those kind of little details, which are beautiful eye candy, but they do kind of texturize the world of the film in a way that a lot of more recent science fiction films set in the future don't really kind of go into. Let's see what else. Saw Cedar Rapids, a comedy film, which was kind of interesting. I kind of liked it for the characters as well. It's got Ed Helms, John C. Reilly, and Haish. Isaiah Whitlock Jr. in it, Stephen Root, Kurtwood Smith, Rob Codry's in it, Sigourney Weaver's in it, Thomas Lennon's in it. Not a fantastic film, but a good, solid little character comedy with an insurance salesman who's led a very sheltered life, going to an insurance convention and having his life changed by the people he meets and the things he does there. It's another good John C. Reilly role. He's never less than excellent, even if he's in a serious character role or if he's yucking it up. John C. Reilly, I have a lot of time for. And Haish is in it. And the nice thing about this comedy, too, is they do give you a textured female role in it. She's kind of a love interest, but kind of not in the film. And, it's worth your time. So if you haven't checked out Cedar Rapids, kind of give it a bit of time. As I said, it's not the best film in the world, but it's a nice, interesting attempt. The only other thing I've really seen is I rewatched Escape from LA because I wanted to get myself a little bit of Snake Plissken happening there. And given the budgetary limitations, I think this is another one that's got a cool future world in it. And it's just a kind of reiteration of Escape from New York in a sense, but I do like the other actors in it as well. Steve Buscemi's in it, of course, Pam Grier's in it. Peter Fonda, a bunch of other people, Cliff Robertson, Stacey Keach. Yeah, it's a lot of fun. It's a pure exploitation, pure action film, and a little bit cool, and it does have a very kind of, wears its left-wing credentials on its sleeve, which I kind of like as well. So that's about it for what I've been watching. I'm going to take a break now because I'm 18 minutes in and I haven't taken a break yet. And when I get back, we'll talk about the first of the two films. I think I'll do Nightmare Alley first. We'll go chronologically with it. So I'll be back in a second. I'll get stuck into that.
I found my love in Avalon beside the bay. I left my love in Avalon and sailed away. I dream of her and Avalon from dusk till dawn. And so I think I'll travel on to Avalon. My love in Avalon beside the bay. I left my love in Avalon and sailed away. I dream of her and Avalon from dusk till dawn. And so I think I'll travel on to Avalon.
That was Nat King Cole with Avalon, an old Al Jolson song from way back in the early 20th century. Okay, let's get on to Nightmare Alley. Really, really cool film. I first saw this one a long, long time ago. It was one of those times back in the day when TV studios did late night movies. And they had old movies. They had people like a guy called Bill Collins talking about them before the movie as well, doing a little bit of what I do, but not showing the film, unlike me. And Nightmare Alley came up, and it blew me away. This film is as dark as a studio film got in the 1940s. It's based on a very, very fine novel by a guy called William Lindsay Gresham. I've got a copy of the novel. I haven't read it in a few years, but I have read it, and it's much darker than, of course, the movie is, and the language is a bit rawer, the sexuality is a little more overt, and if you do get a chance to find the novel, definitely do. It's one of the kind of great sleazo exploitation novels of the 1940s. William Lindsay Gresham was an interesting character too. He actually committed suicide in a Fleabag hotel in New York in 1962. He went into the hotel, he booked himself in there as Asa Kimball of Baltimore, and topped himself. So, yeah, he, like his character in the movie Stanton Carlisle, played by Tyrone Power, had problems with the bottle, and unfortunately he did end his life. So, anyway, on to the movie. Good cast in this one, too. Not a great big, well-known cast, particularly apart from Tyrone Power, who was very much one of 20th Century Fox's golden-haired boys at the time. He'd done things like The Mark of Zorro, and a number of other films where he played the kind of dashing, romantic, leading man. And in this one, he kind of subverts that. He turns it upside down a little bit. So basically, the plot is a guy who is in a carny, a kind of carnival huckster called Stanton Carlisle, played by Tyrone Power, joins the carnival. He works with Mademoiselle Zena, who does a mind-reading act. And Zena and her alcoholic husband, Pete, used to be really big in vaudeville because they had a mind-reading act where they used a word code where the intonation and the choice of words you did basically passed on the information to the blindfolded person who's supposed to have psychic powers and supposed to know what the person's holding up, that kind of thing. So Stan Carlisle con Zena by sleeping with her, it's a good way to do it, into sharing the code with him and a younger girl who's at the carnival called Molly. Now, Molly and Stan basically steal the code from Xena, and after Stan accidentally poisons the alcoholic husband of Xena, Pete, with a bottle of rubbing alcohol. He grabs the wrong bottle out of a suitcase, gives it to him, and he dies from the from drinking rubbing alcohol. So Molly and Stan take the trick on the road and end up doing a very kind of upmarket nightclub act with it, and using that to further their career and to become very well known in a more legitimate form of endeavor. So while he's Stan's very ambitious and very ruthless, and while he meets a psychologist called Lilith Ritter, played by Helen Walker, who's an interesting actress in herself, and I'll talk about her just in a little bit, who basically records information about her patients. Stan finds out she records information on records about her patients and about the sessions she has with her psychiatric patients, and decides that this is a really good way to take his scam to the next level, which is what's known as the spook racket, where he pretends to be able to contact the dead. Now, spook rackets to this day are very popular. People like John Edward and James Van Praagh and all those kind of guys play the same scam as Dan Carlyle does in this movie by pretending to talk to the dead and basically impeding the healing process for people who are bereaved. So Stan and Lilith's very upmarket patients get together. He starts saying that he's in contact with the hereafter. And, of course, as these movies go, he crashes. He's caught out and goes on the lam and ends up back full circle in the carnival. Now, he's not that the carnival is a carnival barker. He's at the carnival as a geek. Now, geek is a word that's changed its meaning into the 21st century from what it was in the 20th century. In the 20th century, a geek was a kind of rummy, alcoholic guy that's picked up by a cheap carnival, put in a pit in a kind of caveman costume. And the act was that people threw live chickens down there and the geek would bite the heads off them and basically act like an animal. And Stan eventually comes full circle and becomes the geek at a circus. In the book, there's no Hollywood redemption, but in the movie, Molly comes and rescues him and all that sort of thing. But leaving that aside, I'll just play a little clip from the trailer of Nightmare Alley just to give you a bit of a feel about it. It's a kind of Faust thing where, you know, the guy reaches the heights and then crashes because of his own weakness as a person. But here's the trailer.
I just have the feeling. That's why I'm going to keep away from you.
You know.
What?
I wonder why I'm like that.
Like what?
Oh, never thinking about anybody. Except myself.
Well, you don't think I'd go without you.
You mean that, Stan?
Absolutely. You satisfied?
Oh, Stan. I don't care for nothing now. Nothing in the world.
You're not a regular MD, are you?
Of course not. But anything my patients reveal to me is as sacred as though it were given under the seal of the confessional. Is that clear?
All right, you don't have to get on a soapbox. I'm going to be strictly on the level about this whole thing myself.
Will you get out of here? I should have known you were that kind of a...
It takes one to catch one. Listen to me. I'm no good. I never pretended to be. But I love you. I'm a hustler. I've always been one. But I love you. I may be the thief of the world, but with you, I've always been on a level.
Yeah, I love this film. Basically, it's it doesn't have particularly a happy ending. Even when Molly finds Stan as he's about to become the geek at the circus, you get in a sense, the story's come full circle because he's in the position that Pete, the alcoholic partner of Mademoiselle Xena, is at. He's the alcoholic being looked after by Molly in the same way that Pete was looked after by Xena. So even though they needed to wrap it up with a romantic ending, this film doesn't end in a very positive note. And it's beautifully shot as well. It's in beautiful black and white. 1947 the film was made. And it's really got that kind of film noir use of shadow and light. They actually built this carnival. There's actually a real carnival that they put in place on a 10-acre piece of ground. So it's not in a studio when they have the carnival scenes. It's actually out in the open, and there's a beautiful sense of depth about the carnival that you get from that. They don't kind of cram things together that fit them into a studio. And I do like that. It does give a sense of reality to the carnival, and you get that also, that sense of hidden knowledge being revealed. The carnival scams, the way that Xena does her mind reading act in the carnival before she gives the word code to Stan. They do a different kind of act where people write their questions on cards, and Stan takes them up on stage, and Xena burns the cards and then pretends to know what's on them through the ether and to answer people's questions. Of course, the cards are palmed off to Pete, who's underneath the stage, and shows Xena on a blackboard what the questions are. So basically, the hidden world of carnival scams is revealed a little bit in the movie, and I kind of like that idea of hidden knowledge and the fact that the movie says that anybody who says they can talk to the dead, anybody who plays these kind of games, is full of bullshit. And it's a lesson that a lot of people should learn, because there are a lot of people still being scammed by these kind of bastards. And this film is the kind of 1947 reveal of exactly what a cold reading is. In fact, there are a couple of times, once when Pete does it to Stan and once when Stan does it to somebody else in a hobo jungle, where a cold reading is used. And if you don't know what a cold reading is, it's that one where they kind of say they see certain generic things and people link them into their own lives. They're open questions. They're answers that fit anybody. And it slowly pulls people into believing that this person has some kind of psychic abilities. Yeah, he talks about a young barefoot boy running through the hills with a dog at his heels. Everybody had that in their childhood at some stage. And using that cold reading technique. So this film is a kind of touchstone for skeptics. And I do like it for that as well. And it really was. It was one of the least successful movies that Tyrone Power ever made from the box office point of view. The audiences who saw him as a romantic lead, and he had a very large following among women, didn't really like seeing him as somebody who was about to bite the head off a chicken and playing a total ruthless bastard. Of course, Hollywood softened the back end of the film to a large extent, but really it's one of those things that really does take this film out of the ordinary. Now, it'd be a good one to do a remake of, in fact. You could do a period piece remake, maybe with HBO, to kind of tell the darker story that's actually a part of the original novel by Gresham. And you know, if you got the right actor and the right cast together, you could really kind of go to town with this one and blast it. Here's what Variety magazine said about the movie, allowing for that fact that the movie itself had the softened ending. Variety said, Nightmare Alley is a harsh, brutal story told with the sharp clarity of an etching. Most vivid of these is Joan Blondell as the girl who works for the Secrets of the Mind Reading Act. Colleen Gray is sympathetic and convincing as his steadfast wife and partner Molly in the act. And Helen Walker comes through successfully as a calculating female who topples power from the heights of fortune back to degradation as a geek at the carny. And so that's basically it. And the interesting thing is the Lilith character, Lilith Ritter, played by Helen Walker, is a really interesting character. She's kind of essayed as sexually ambiguous as well. She dresses in very masculine suits. She runs her own business as a psychologist. And there's, even though she does kind of make an oblique pass at Stan, there's a kind of coded lesbianism to her. The fact that she eventually shafts him and really does turn the tables around makes her an interesting character in the pantheon of film noir femmes fatales. She's not necessarily a femme fatale. She's a kind of this role could almost have been played by a man, in a sense. And that's an interesting choice there. In the book, I believe she's coded a little more strongly towards that kind of sexuality. But, of course, with the production code, they had to kind of go a bit subterranean on implying certain things. And I think they do it very well in this case. Helen Walker had an unfortunate life in a lot of ways. She, just at the end of the war, she was driving from Palm Springs to Los Angeles and picked up some hitchhiking soldiers. Everybody was giving lifts to soldiers when they needed to get from army bases to home and all that sort of thing. And she crashed the car with the three soldiers, and one of them died. And there was a lot of implication that she was actually drunk and driving at 90 miles an hour and crashed because she was drunk. And the publicity from that really put the kibosh on her career to a large extent. And, you know, this is just one of those minor Hollywood scandals that she didn't have enough of clout in the studio to cover this up. And because they were returned soldiers and they just won the war and they had... were very much appreciated in society, the fact that she'd actually killed one in a car accident because she was drinking at the time. Whether she was drinking or not, or whether it was just said she was drinking, I don't know. But it really did knock her career. And this film was made soon after that, and there's a certain hardness to the Lilith character that I think may have been fed into by Helen Walker's personal problems. And I kind of... find that interesting. I don't find it commendable that she turned that into something she could use in her art, but just having that little backstory to her makes the character just that little more sort of believable, in a sense. And also that toughness that the Lilith character has is obviously part of Helen Walker's toughness, because she had to kind of live through that and get her career back on track, and that takes a certain amount of guts when you fucked up that badly, but you're still out there punching. So the film, it's beautiful. Really is one of those films that people talk about when they talk about film noir, and when they talk about classic films of the 40s, or indeed when they talk about the kind of carnival scams that still go on with people talking to deceased parents and daughters and all those other things. It really is something kids should be... this should be part of any kind of film study thing that kids do in school, so that people know that this kind of shit is a scam and they're educated early in those kind of scams. And the sort of people who ruthlessly and cold-heartedly go about them. Stan Carlisle, the character Tyrone Power plays, is interesting as well. He had a very brutal upbringing in an orphanage and then a boys' school, and was beaten up, and found that the way through that was to scam the people running the schools, and the and that he was pious and religious and he could quote the scriptures, and he really conned them that he believed in this stuff even when he didn't, as a survival thing. And I find that nice that they bothered to put the backstory in there. Stan Carlisle is basically a sociopath. Towards the end, when everything's on the downfall, he is very soft towards Molly, his wife. But for the rest of the film, he's kind of focused on what he wants and what he needs and what he can con out of other people. And that really does carry through. And I think if you disregard the little bits, which are fairly obvious patches that are put in there by the studio to soften things up for the production code, it's a very interesting character piece. And I think it's one of Tyrone Power's best bits of acting. He wasn't a fantastic actor, but he was always a trier, in a sense. He, in things like Witness for the Prosecution, later on in his career, he had some interesting thing, and The Sun Also Rises and those sort of movies. But this one really is the one where his looks were just starting on to fade a little bit, so he wasn't the pretty boy anymore. He was a handsome man. And he really took this role on to, after the war, he'd been in the war and he'd been a Marine in the war. After the war, to kind of change his career. He knew he couldn't keep playing the same kind of roles he'd played previously. He didn't want to particularly, from what I can understand, play those roles as well. And so he went on for this dark one. It wasn't successful because people really didn't buy him as that kind of non-matinee idol sort of character. But really, It's a tough, gritty film, and it does deliver the goods in a lot of ways. So I'll just play another clip from that and end with Nightmare Alley. But if you haven't seen it, do so. If you have seen it and haven't seen it for a while, it's worth revisiting as well. It really does have some psychological depth to it. It's a hard, gritty story. And I think that in spite of the censorship restrictions, which is what the production code was, it was self-imposed censorship. Within those censorship restrictions, I think the people making this film, Eben Golding, the director and the writers and the actors, really did put as much guts into this film as they possibly could. Golding had actually worked with Tyrone Power once before in The Razor's Edge, the adaptation of the Somerset Maugham novel, which I do like. I do like the original version, 1946, Razor's Edge. It was remade by, of all people, Bill Murray playing the main character in Razor's Edge, and it doesn't really work in the Bill Murray version. But if you want to see Bill Murray doing something different, you can check out the one he did. I think it was in the early 1980s, the version of The Razor's Edge with Teresa Russell in it as well. Not a success, but you've never seen Bill Murray play a more different character than in that one. So there we go. We've tied Tyrone Power and Bill Murray together in the thing. So as I said, I'll play that little clip from Nightmare Alley and then get on with the next film, which of course is Network, the Paddy Chayefsky written, Sidney Lumet directed film.
Boy, you should have seen us work once.
I heard you were pretty good by yourself.
Chord from the orchestra, amber spot, and I'm on. Make me spiel, good for one laugh, plenty of mystery.
Wait a minute.
Yes? Go right into my reading. Huh. Here's my crystal. Throughout the ages, man has sought to look behind the veil that hides him from tomorrow. And through the ages, certain men have looked into the polished crystal and seen. Is it some quality of the crystal itself? Or does the gazer merely use it to turn his gaze inward? Who knows? But visions come. Slowly shifting their form, visions come. Wait. The shifting shapes begin to clear. I see fields of grass, rolling hills, and a boy. A boy is running barefoot through the hills. A dog is with him. A dog is with him.
Yes. His name was Jip. Go on.
See how easy it is to hook them?
I have a small advance to purchase
this
the necessary...
This show is too high class for a mitt camp. Besides, palmistry always gets you in trouble with the law.
Well, I'm pretty good at magic, too, sir.
Magicians are a dime a dozen nowadays. Would you like another?
Maybe.
Go ahead. Anyway, I never fool with an act unless it's got something sensational.
Yeah. Yeah, sure.
Wait. I just happened to think of something. I might have a job you can take a crack at. Of course, it isn't much, and I'm not begging you to take it, but it's a job.
Yeah, well, that's all I want.
And we'll keep you in coffee and cakes, bottle every day, place to sleep it off in. What do you say? Anyway, it's only temporary, just until we can get a real geek.
Geek.
You know what a geek is, don't you?
Yeah. Sure, I know what a geek is.
Do you think you can handle it?
Mister, I was made for it.
Yosh, yosh. Have I had a podcast? I podcast in the morning. I podcast in the evening, all over the Schwannwald. I talk about Hammer. I talk about Amicus. I talk about every kind of wish point in between, especially about Neil Connery. I'm a podcast.com.
Crack. Q Howard.
I don't have to tell you things are bad. Everybody knows things are bad. It's a depression. Everybody's out of work or scared of losing their job. The dollar buys a nickel's worth. Banks are going bust. Shopkeepers keep a gun under the counter. Punks are running wild in the street, and there's nobody anywhere who seems to know what to do, and there's no end to it. We know the air is unfit to breathe and our food is unfit to eat. We sit watching our TVs while some local newscaster tells us that today we had 15 homicides and 63 violent crimes, as if that's the way it's supposed to be. We know things are bad, worse than bad. They're crazy. It's like everything everywhere is going crazy, so we don't go out anymore. We sit in the house, and slowly the world we're living in is getting smaller, and all we say is, please, at least leave us alone in our living rooms. Let me have my toaster and my TV and my steel-belted radios, and I won't say anything. Just leave us alone. Well, I'm not going to leave you alone. I want you to get mad. I don't want you to protest. I don't want you to riot. I don't want you to write to your congressman because I wouldn't know what to tell you to write. I don't know what to do about the depression and the inflation and the Russians and the crime in the street. All I know is that first, you've got to get mad. You've got to say, I'm a human being. God damn it. My life has value. So, I want you to get up now. I want all of you to get up out of your chairs. I want you to get up right now and go to the window, open it, and stick your head out and yell, I'm as mad as hell, and I'm not going to take this anymore! I want you to get up right now. Get up, go to your windows, open them, and stick your head out and yell, I'm as mad as hell, and I'm not going to take this anymore. Things have got to change.
How many stations does this go out?
You've got to get mad.
67. I know it goes to Louisville and Atlanta.
We're not going to take this anymore. Then we'll figure out what to do about the depression and the inflation and the oil crisis. But first, get up out of your chairs, open the window, stick your head out and yell, and say, I'm as mad as hell, and I'm not going to take this anymore.
Networks, a 1976 American satirical film released by MGM about a fictitious television network, Union Broadcasting System, and a struggle with poor ratings. The film was written by Paddy Chayefsky and directed by Sidney Lumet. It stars Faye Dunaway, William Holden, Peter Finch, and Robert Duvall, and features Wesley Addy, Ned Beatty, and Beatrice Straight. It won 4 Oscars in the categories of Best Actor for Peter Finch, Best Actress Faye Dunaway, Best Supporting Actress for Beatrice Straight, and Best Original Screenplay for Paddy Chayefsky. So that's basically it with the film. The film's about a TV studio and about their main distinguished newsreader, Howard Beale. His wife died a few years before, and he's an alcoholic. And he goes on the radio just after the... on television, sorry. I've got radio on my mind. It goes on the television just after they've given him the bullet, and he says this.
Q Howard.
Ladies and gentlemen, I would like at this moment to announce that I will be retiring from this program in 2 weeks' time because of poor ratings. Since this show was the only thing I had going for me in my life, I have decided to kill myself.
So what she said?
I'm going to blow my brains out right on this program. A week from today.
10 seconds to commercial.
Oh, tune in next Tuesday. That should give the public relations people a week to promote the show. You ought to get a hell of a rating out of that.
Well, tell us
50 share. Easy.
Take Telecity.
When you're having a great time...
Did you hear that?
What was that about?
Howard just said he was going to blow his brains out next Tuesday.
What are you talking about?
Didn't you hear him? He
What's
just
wrong?
Said...
No.
Howard just said he was going to kill himself next Tuesday.
So, of course, Howard isn't allowed to go back on TV, but the guy who runs the news division of the TV network, played by William Holden, a guy called, he said, looking this up, Max Schumacher, played by William Holden, decides he's going to give Howard another chance and gives Howard the opportunity to have a more dignified exit. He's aware that Howard, who's a close friend of his, is having a breakdown, and he wants to give him kind of that little chance to go out with a bit of gravitas. But Howard then launches into a rant about how everything in life is bullshit and how much TV is bullshit, and goes into an enormous rant on the television. Now, you might recall from a brief Aaron Sorkin TV show called Studio 60. Starts out with this kind of a rant by the guy who runs the comedy show that the TV series is based on. This is one of the great rants of television. It's an angry man having a breakdown and mentally impaired, railing against everything he sees wrong with the world around him. And it's beautiful. There's some fantastic writing in this film. There really is. It's didactic. It's a kind of satire on society, but it's got some really great speeches and some really great opportunities for actors to act. There's a lot of shouting in the film too. Ned Beatty shouts and William Holden shouts and Peter Finch shouts and Robert Duvall shouts and Faye Dunaway shouts and Beatrice Straight won an Oscar for Best Supporting Actress for one scene which runs only a few minutes. She plays Max Schumacher's wife. She finds out that Max, he actually tells her that he's having an affair with Diana Christensen, the character played by Faye Dunaway, who basically is, like in Nightmare Alley, we have another movie here with a sociopath in it. She's focused on her job. She's really almost an Asperger's case, focused on her job and things like that. Max Schumacher has an affair with her and decides he's in love with her and decides to tell his wife. And Beatrice Straight has this great, great scene. She's only given two scenes in the film, one earlier and when Howard stays over at the Schumacher's place after his initial rant, and this one. And it's a beautiful piece of writing and a beautiful piece of acting. I think it deserves the Oscar, even though it's only a short piece. It's a bit like Ben Johnson's Best Supporting Actor Oscar for The Last Picture Show. It's a small chunk of the film, but it's an incredible piece of writing. It's an incredible piece of acting where she talks about and kind of gives the context to the relationship that these two people have. And really does articulate the dignity and rage of a woman who's been betrayed in her middle years by her husband, who is having an affair with a much younger woman. And in spite of more than the ranting of Peter Finch's, which I admire a lot, and more than almost anything else in this film, I love that little piece with Beatrice Straight in there, which does have an incredible weight to it. And, I mean, we all know people who, the woman's in their 40s, the husband leaves for a younger woman or has an affair with a younger woman. And the changes it can make to a woman's life when that sort of thing occurs. And I think Beatrice Straight in this film really does essay that fantastically well. There are some stupid parts in this film, I'll be honest with you. The bits where they decide to do a TV show called the Mao Zedong Hour, where an equivalent of the Symbionese Liberation Army is used for a kind of reality television show about acts of domestic terrorism. And they decide they're going to run with that in spite of the fact that the FBI and everybody else is against it because it rates. And this TV network is on the skids, and things like how Bill ranting and raving about how rotten society is and how rotten the world is and eventually how rotten the network and the network's corporate structure is really does pay. There's bucks in this. They can make money out of it, and that's part of it. But more than any of that, there are a couple of humor moments. There are a couple of speeches. And the film is mostly speeches. There are a couple of speeches made by William Holden, Beatrice Straight, and Peter Finch that really do take this to another level. I think the broad satire of the other television shows, even though they are very prophetic, and if they possibly could, I don't doubt that somebody would do a reality TV show with terrorists as the protagonists if they thought they could get away with it. But leaving all of that aside, the film is one of the great movies about television. It goes into the fact that television, like Ernie Kovacs said, is called a medium because it's neither rare nor well done. And really, it's this movie was unashamed in saying that. Now, you've got to remember that Paddy Chayefsky also did another Academy Award-winning movie called Marty in the 1950s, which originally started as a play for television. And Chayefsky did write for television in the 50s. And then 20 years later, Network came out. So he hadn't worked in television for a while, but he did have a strong familiarity with the way the internal politics of television works and the way that money is incredibly important, more so than the dignity of the people involved in the TV thing. I mean, it's fairly obvious that Howard Beale obviously has a drinking problem and is obviously having a psychotic episode in this movie. And that's of less importance than his marketability as a product to the people who have worked with him for 20 years. With the possible exception of William Holden's character, who, because of their friendship, really does have a different angle on it. And he, in some ways, is at least partly the voice of sanity in this film. Not always, and he is distracted by the fact that Diana Christensen is throwing herself at him because she's got a father complex and likes older men. And basically is focused on what she wants. He's very much distracted by that, and it does have an impact on his life. And there's a nice little bit at the end where he talks about the changes that the affair and the whole Howard Beale situation have made in his life. And I kind of like that a lot. I like the fact that the character, some of the characters are given depth, and I think that even the Diana Christensen character, even when she's off negotiating with terrorists for a cut of the money for the TV show, which is very successful, it really, there are some little grace touches of deeper characterization in spite of the fact that this movie is supposed to be a satire. And as I said, there are aspects of the satire that don't work anywhere near as well. I'll just play another clip from the film just to give you a little more on the speechifying that goes on in Network.
The UBS Evening News with Howard Beale.
Ready to? To Q Howard.
Good evening. Today is Wednesday, September the 24th, and this is my last broadcast. Yesterday, I announced on this program that I was going to commit public suicide. Admittedly, an act of madness. Well, I'll tell you what happened. I just ran out of bullshit.
All right, cut him off.
Leave him on.
Am I still on the air?
If this is how he wants to go out, this is how
he goes out. I don't know any other way to say it, except that I just ran out of bullshit.
Yeah. Look, Mr. Schumacher's right here. Do you want to talk to him?
Bullshit is all the reasons we give for living. And if we can't think of any reasons of our own, we always have the God bullshit.
Holy Mary, Mother of Christ.
We don't know why we're going through all this pointless pain, humiliation, and decay, so there better be someone somewhere who does know. That's the God bullshit.
He's saying that life is like bullshit, God, and it is. So what are you screaming bullshit about?
Man is a noble creature that can order his own world. Who needs God? Well, if there's anybody out there that can look around this demented slaughterhouse of a world we live in and tell me that man is a noble creature, believe me, that man is full of bullshit.
What's so goddamn funny?
I can't help it, Harry. It's funny.
I don't have anything.
Thanks. This is going out live to 67.
I don't have any kids.
Leave him on.
And I was married for 33 years of shrill, shrieking fraud.
Mr. Hackett's trying to get through to you.
Tell Mr. Hackett to go fuck himself.
So I don't have any bullshit left. I just ran out of it, you see.
Last night, I was awakened from a fitful sleep shortly after 2 o'clock in the morning by a shrill, sibilant, faceless voice.
I couldn't make it out at first in the dark bedroom. And I said, I'm sorry, you'll have to talk a little louder.
What do you want me to do?
Nothing.
And the voice said to me, I want you to tell the people the truth. Not an easy thing to do because the people don't want to know the truth. And I said, you're kidding. What the hell should I know about the truth? But the voice said to me, don't worry about the truth. I will put the words in your mouth. And I said, what is this, the burning bush? For God's sake, I'm not Moses. And the voice said to me, and I'm not God. What has that got to do with it? And the voice said to me, we're not talking about eternal truth or absolute truth or ultimate truth. We're talking about impermanent, transient, human truth. I don't expect you people to be capable of truth, but God damn it, at least you're capable of self-preservation. And I said, why me? And the voice said, because you're on television, dummy.
One of the main inspirations for this film was a television news reporter called Christine Chubbuck in Sarasota, Florida in the early 1970s. She was an anchor woman for the local TV station, and she was suffering from depression and was arguing with her editors, and she shot herself in front of the camera as people watched television on July 15th, 1974. And Chayefsky used that as the kind of kicking off point for Network. It was a big shock to people at the time, and the footage no longer exists. Of course, people will look it up on YouTube, and to be honest with you, I did as well, but it's not there. And really, that was one of the main things that kicked off the thing. Chayefsky and his producer Howard Godfrey, I'm reading this off Wikipedia by the way, had just come off a lawsuit against United Artists challenging the studio's rights to lease their previous film, The Hospital, to ABC in a package with a less successful film. And they basically, in spite of the fact that the lawsuit, they signed a deal with United Artists to finance Network until United Artists found that the subject matter was too controversial and they backed out, so they took it over to MGM. And the film is one of the great films of the 1970s because it has something to say about the world as it was at the time. And yes, it is speechifying. It's purely a didactic piece of stuff. They do say it's a satire, but I'm not sure that it's as strong a satire as it is a strong piece of propaganda. The fact that the TV networks really do have a stranglehold over the people that work for them, and they still do to a certain extent. There are any number of, if you look through do a little bit of a web search, there are any number of TV newsreaders and TV presenters and TV people who do have problems, some of which are addressed effectively and some of which are not. And it is a high-pressure work. Millions of dollars depend on what these people do. And, of course, the same goes for actors in movies as well. But I think the main cry for help that comes out of a movie network is that people with these kind of problems aren't a cash cow. They should not be treated as such. One of the things I did notice when I was watching the film, too, is how similar Glenn Beck's shtick is to Howard Beale's. And I think that in a cold, calculating manner, a Fox News person, he's not with Fox News now, but he was with Fox News, like Glenn Beck, and to a certain extent Bill O'Reilly, have tapped into that kind of articulation of rage and articulation of frustration that the Howard Beale character in Network does have. Of course, they're using it for a totally different purpose and with shrewd and narrow-eyed calculation. But I don't think that if Howard Beale hadn't existed as a character and if Peter Finch hadn't been so effective in that role, that we would have a lot of these circus clowns on Fox News that we do find ourselves with. So there's not much else to say about this film. There probably is a lot else to say, and I'd like to hear what you think about it. But for me, I saw the film first in the 1970s, and yeah, it did tap into that kind of thing. There was a little bit of a minor depression at the time. The fuel crisis was there. And having somebody on television just cutting through the bullshit was a strong symbolic gesture, even if it was in a kind of fictional context at the time. Television was such a controlled medium before it diversified with cable and all those sort of other interesting sidelines, including the internet, of course, because there's a lot of video on the internet now. But before that, there was such a controlled environment, and news was such a kind of castle in the air kind of thing, where the people in ivory towers were telling us what was happening in the world, and it was filtered through their perceptions and the agendas they had, much, much more than it is now. So I think that this movie may have contributed to changing that in some way. And, of course, it is considered one of the great movies of the 1970s for that reason. Yeah, Chayefsky went over the top with it, and yes, there's a lot of ranting in the film. But there's a place for that in cinema. There's a place for a movie that isn't a scream against the bullshit. And I don't mind a film like that. If it does it well, I really don't mind it. I mean, I think that a lot of the episodes of The West Wing and other things Aaron Sorkin has done have been that kind of scream against irrationality, a scream against selfishness, a scream against greed, and the psychopaths who run a lot of our institutions these days. And for that reason, I like it. There is one story I can tell you about Peter Finch, which is a true story. My grandfather was in World War II with Peter Finch, and they were both working for the Catering Corps in New Guinea at the time. And one of the interesting things was my grandfather, who was in his 40s at the time, taught Finchy how to steal supplies off American GI's trucks so that when they went to their camp kitchens and cooked up the food for the soldiers, they had something decent to give them. So he taught, he and Finch were there nicking things off the back of American trucks to help out the Australian war effort. So anyway, and that's another reason why I've got a fondness for Peter Finch, apart from the fact that he had an Australian father and he grew up in Australia before he worked with Laurence Olivier and Vivian Leigh when they came over to do Shakespeare in the 1940s here in Australia. They did a touring Shakespeare company, and Finchie had an affair with Vivian Leigh at the time, and parlayed that relationship into a career in British film in the 1950s and 1960s. And of course, the international fame he had in the 60s and 70s was all part of that. So it does go to show you that if you are a jobbing actor, it doesn't hurt to slip a link to a famous female actor at various times. It can be a positive career move. So that's about it for Network, leaving it on a high note. What I'll do now is I'll take another break and I'll play a promo for another of our worthy podcast colleagues, and we'll get back with the feedback.
Do you enjoy movies like Carnival of Souls, The Mole People, Black Sunday, and The Tingler? Do you find yourself late at night reading magazines such as Film Max, Chiller Theater, or Monster Bash? Do you love vintage television programs like Sky King, Outer Limits, and The Time Tunnel? Do you find yourself surfing the net looking for the next monster movie festival or expo? Do you enjoy hearing anecdotes, cinematic details, and unusual insights into some of your favorite movies? If you answered yes to any of the above, you are encouraged to join your host, Vince Rotolo, as he examines some of the latest horror, sci-fi, and cult theatrical releases, new DVDs to add to your collection, and of course, the old classics, both good and bad. He even interviews people throughout B-Moviedom. So tune into B-MovieCast at bmoviecast.com.
Resistance is futile.
Yeah, I've got a couple of emails from Morris Brzezinski from Love That Album podcast. I'll just bring those up on here. First one says, "Hi, Terry. Hope all is well with you and Sal. Hopefully Jack the Cat has come down from his teabag-induced high." Yeah, Jack got into a peppermint teabag and went a bit spaz with it. I finally got around to watching La Demoiselle's The Rochefort, the film you reviewed so glowingly on ABC Darwin. It's taken a long time for my order to come in and a few weeks for me to actually get around to watching. I don't want to seem like I have a heart of stone, but I couldn't get too emotionally involved with the story. On the positive side, the songs written by Michel Legrand have strong, memorable melodies and are brilliantly arranged. The film looks beautiful. I don't know if, from a technical perspective, film experts would say it's compositionally right or not, but it looks fantastic to me. look and light of the film reflects its mood very well. In a way, therein lies part of my problem with the film. The story is so light and airy that it really failed to sustain my interest. I understand the idea of the story is about mischances, but the characters played by Catherine Deneuve and François d'Orliac seem all too self-absorbed for me to really care about their plight of wanting true love to come around the corner and knock on their door. I was originally interested to hear that George Takiris and Gene Kelly were in the film, but the choreography was a weak point in the film, and that not even these fine dancers could save. Don't Shoot Me Down in Flames, I keep returning to the soundtrack. As I said, I think that's brilliant, but the film is a bit of a disappointment. Maybe I need to understand the whole French New Wave movement to put the film in context. Jules and Jim put an end to me wanting to learn more about it. I can't stand that film. Anyway, have a great holiday season. Be well, and I look forward to more paleo cinema in 2012. Cheers, Morris. Yeah, I mean, I don't think it's for everybody. I know Pauline Kael was very negative about the film as well. But I don't mind the fact that it's a bit of a confection. It's a bit of a parfait of a film. I do like it. I think that one of the other things you should see is you should actually see The Umbrellas of Cherbourg as well. That was the earlier film that Jacques Demy did with Catherine Deneuve. And I think that one's a bit more meaty as far as plot line and incorporating the music with the plot is concerned. So you might want to consider that one. But yeah, I respect your opinion on that. And really, yeah, I mean, the music, of course, is marvellous, and Michel Legrand's always a rich source of interesting film music. So I'll go on to your second email. It says, "Hello, Terry. Happy New Year to you. I hope you enjoy your time off. I'm still off work for another couple of weeks, and I've been catching up on a bunch of films, podcasts, getting surfing lessons with my kids, and generally enjoying life." Glad to hear it, mate. I introduced my son Max to a couple of Kurosawa films, Drunken Angel and Ran. Hadn't seen either of these films before last week's, but we both loved them. The mood set up in the opening frames of Drunken Angel, with his vision of the bacteria-infested lake that the film keeps returning to, works well. Served as a great metaphor for the two main characters who are flawed but not without conscience. Wish I'd seen Ran on the big screen. Has Yester shown it? I don't know. This was given as a present to Max by his grade 6 teacher, knowing Max's taste. I found out that Kurosawa had originally trained as an artist and looked at composition of a lot. And looking at the composition of a lot of this film, I understand that completely. It's a beautiful looking film, and the conflict of the story rivaled any modern day political tale. I'd read King Lear at school, but I wish I had this to watch at the time. I'm going to have to watch Drunken Angel now, so bear with me on that. We also watch What's Up, Doc? And Bring Out Baby. No secret where Bogdanovich got his inspiration from there. Catherine Hepburn and Cary Grant were a bloody good comedy team, and I'm sure they provided inspiration to Barbara Streisand and Ryan O'Neill. Yeah, I'm not that fond of What's Up, Doc? I think it's a little too consciously an homage to earlier films, and I don't think that Barbara Streisand worked in that context. I remember being interested in it when I first watched it in the 1970s. But I did watch it more recently, and both Ryan O'Neill and Barbara Streisand didn't really strike me as interesting. Morris goes on to say, "I'm interested to read that you're covering, or have already covered by the time you read this, Network. I saw this when it came out, and I was about 13 years old. While some of the themes eluded me at the time, I still saw it as a bloody good tale. Seeing it again in recent years reminded me of the story, that the story is all too relevant, unfortunately. 21st century has caught up with Paddy vision, or at least it's become more pronounced. There's a great scene in Midnight Cowboy that sums up TV mentality when John Boyd is sitting in his hotel room watching TV, despondent that being a hustle on the streets in New York is not as easy as he thought. He's watching a Tonight type show and sees a poor dog being dressed up in ridiculous clothes to audiences howls of laughter. Do the TV viewing public want this as an entertainment, or will we force this and grow to accept it in the absence of anything more challenging? Do we get what we deserve? In Network, why did the TV audience want to embrace a suicidal Howard Beale? The hypocrisies he points out would not have made ratings if he had delivered them in a calm, rational manner. Once again, do we ask this via the shock jocks of the world, or are we comfortably numb? Okay, enough of my bullshit. Have a great New Year, Terry. Can I request that you get the tea part of the 80s project? You consider covering the Ernst Lubitsch version of To Be or Not To Be. For the record, I'm not a director of the Mel Brooks version. Cheers, Morris." Yeah, I'll consider it. I'm not sure what I'm going to do for tea yet. I'm still looking at O at this stage. I've got a couple of ideas for that. But I've got it on the list as a possible for tea, so I'll definitely put it down there. Yeah, I mean, Network, I think, there's a certain aspect to TV in particular with this kind of programming that it's a bit of bread and circuses for the masses. It's a safe dissenting voice in a sense. One of the other things I did see recently was Charlie Brooker's 3-part anthology TV series, the BBC showed last year, called, I think it's Black Screen or something like, Black Mirror. The first episode of that is interesting, and all of them relate more or less to some form of media. I'll give you the premise of the first episode of Black Mirror, so people might want to find it on a torrent. A royal princess in England is kidnapped, and there's one demand made when she's kidnapped, and she's kind of like a princess, Di Kate Middleton sort of character. There's only one demand made, that the Prime Minister of England fuck a pig live on television. And that's the premise of the story, and that plays out after that. So, really interesting little series there, and it does kind of address the public's hunger for sensation in media. It does a little bit of political stuff as well, and I think that a lot of people would find that something that they'd watch, a political figure humiliated on television by getting him to fuck a pig. So, that kind of came up when I was reading your email for some reason. If you can see Black Mirror, there's only 3 episodes, and they used to run about an hour or so. And they're all slightly science fictional, and they're all very, very good. Media, I think Fox News is inspired by network in a lot of ways. It would have had to have been. It's one of those things that took television news into new and dark areas. As to whether, if he had been rational about it, it would have rated, I don't know. But I do know, for instance, Jon Stewart and Stephen Colbert, their idea of comedy being the sweet coating on the dark side of the news is an interesting approach. I think it's a more benign approach than the kind of shock jock, hideous mentality that Fox News and people like Andrew Bolt here in Australia purvey. I think that there is an argument for, in some way, packaging unpleasant truths in a different way. I think the comedy thing works better than the political agendas that places like Fox News have. But, yeah, Chayefsky really was onto something there. And I really think that, in that sense, Network is an incredibly valuable film. So thanks for that feedback, Morris. I'll get on to... by the way, the other place to offer and give feedback, and that I've got an ongoing dialogue on, is the Paleo Cinema Cafe on Facebook. We get Dr. Zom popping things in there occasionally. I get a few comments from other people who are enjoying the podcast. Unfortunately, it's a little hard for me to kind of put them into this format, but please go over to the Paleo-Cinema Cafe at Facebook. You can subscribe to that without friending me up if you don't want to particularly friend me up, but I want to get a kind of Facebook groups seem to be the place where a lot of this stuff's happening in podcasts and other media at the moment. I really want to kind of get things going there and have people discussing things. I'll pop silly things in there. Sometimes I'll pop in music videos from the 1940s. I'll put in the trailers for the films I'm going to talk about on Paleo Cinema. So definitely... pop over there if you're interested and put in what you would like to put in there. Now, it wouldn't be a Paleo Cinema if we didn't have a little bit from Dr. Zom. I do know that at least one of our listeners isn't in love with Dr. Zom at all, but to be honest with you, Zom's been a great supporter of this podcast and a great promoter of this podcast and his own podcast, Silver and Gold, S-I-L-V-A and Gold. If you're looking for something a bit transgressive when people talk about movies, that's the place to go for that. And I think that Zom and Pikolov should really send me a promo for Silver and Gold. I'd be very, very happy to play one. It's very different from what I do, very different from Gentleman's Guide to Midnight Cinema and some other podcasts. But the guys are having fun with it, and they're actually talking about some very interesting films these days. They've settled down the format a lot, and they are talking about some films that I might well have talked about on the podcast, given the opportunity. So anyway, I'm going to play Dr. Zom's thing and we'll wrap this puppy up.
Hello, Paleo Cinema. This is Dr. Zom, and I'm calling to speak to you about a movie, and in particular, the starlet of a movie that I watched recently. The movie was called Vice Raid. The starlet, a blonde bombshell, if you will, Mamie Van Doren. Now, Paleo Cinema, as I scratch my nose and the dogs are chewing the bones beside me on the couch, I knew and know little about Mamie Van Doren, except for the hair, except for the boobies. I had heard of her, of course, quite a bit, in comparison to Marilyn Monroe and Jane Mansfield. At the time, Hollywood was full of blonde bombshells. It was a blonde bombshell factory. But I did get to see her in Vice Raid with Brad Dexter and Richard Coogan. Pretty much a B-class black-and-white quickie movie. Kind of a cop gangster thingy, which I liked. I mean, even though it was a B-movie, I kind of liked those. They have a lot of them on Netflix Insta-watch. I did find Mamie Van Doren to be quite alluring. The only thing I knew about her knew about her was, I believe, and you can correct me if I am incorrect, but I believe she dated one Elvis Presley at one time. But I haven't seen her in anything else. I'd like to know your thoughts on Mamie Van Doren, and if you have any movies that she might be in that you might find particularly to be interesting. Right now, the chewing of these bones is driving me crazy as they go to town sounding like Anthony Hopkins in Silence of the Lambs, chewing on the bones of Glee Starling. Have the lambs stopped screaming, Terry Frost? Anyway, I gotta go. I don't know why, but I do. Mm-hmm. This is Dr. Zom saying so long, Australia.
Thanks for that, Zom. I don't actually think much about Mamie Van Doren. She doesn't pop up much on my radar. Let's see. She was in Yankee Pasha, which was Jeff Chandler adventure flick in the 1950s. Let's see, 1954 adventure romance with Jeff Chandler and Rhonda Fleming. Lee J. Cobb was in it playing a sultan, which is never a bad thing. Interesting choice of an actor to play a sultan. Let's see what else we can find out. She was uncredited in Jet Pilot, which was the Howard Hughes, John Wayne film, I think. Was it Howard Hughes? No. Yeah, it was Howard Hughes produced it. So she was in there. Let's have a look and see what else I can find out about Mamie Van Doren. She was in Francis Joins the Wax with Francis the Talking Mule, which is probably about her level of cinema. Sex Kittens Go to College. You can always appreciate any movie with sex in the name. The Private Lives of Adam and Eve, I think with Mickey Rooney. It was a comedy. I'm going to have to try to find a copy of that, but I'm not sure why. It's got Tuesday World, Mel Torme in it, Martin Milner, Cecil Kellaway, Paul Anka. With that cast, I'm going to have to find it. But, yeah, I mean, she's still alive, too. If you go to her Wikipedia page, there's a picture of her in 2007. And to be honest with you, at the moment she is 80 years old, heading on for 81. And she still gets the baps out a little bit, looking a little bit fossilized. In fact, she looks plastinated, kind of like those corpses you find in those exhibitions. She's looking a little bit like that these days. But then who the hell doesn't when they're 81 years old? Let's see, Voyage of the Planet of Prehistoric Women. She was in that. Three Nuts in Search of a Bolt, which I think is not about Andrew Bolt. The Sheriff Was a Lady. Yeah, never really big in the cinema, but big in the chest. So that's my bit on Mamie Van Doren. Not that interested in her. I mean, there are Rhonda Fleming. Yeah, Rhonda Fleming was interesting. She was a bit sexy. And there are only a number of other those so-called sex kittens from the 1960s who are interesting. And by the way, MamieVanDoren.com, if you go there, you can find out all about her. And there are YouTube videos and other little bits and pieces. You can actually buy Mamie Van Doren wine. Which is, hang on, give me a look. Wait a second. I'm just looking at a webpage. Mamie Van Doren has released a wine called Mamacitage, $130 a bottle. There are new photos of her on the wine in her 70s. And yeah. So if you want a 7-year-old woman naked on a bottle of wine, go to mamievandoren.com. I'm going to have to investigate that webpage later. Anyway, that's about it for Paleo Cinema this time. Next time around, we probably hit the letter O, and then the fortnight after that, I'm probably going to get Paul Polton back so we can talk about The Great Race and also The Private Life of Sherlock Holmes. So that's about it. Everyone take care of yourselves. Go to all of the usual suspects as far as podcasts are concerned. Hamicus, B-Movie Cast, Silver and Gold, The Gentleman's Guide to Midnight Cinema, Shooting the Pooh Podcast, The Writer and the Critic, Galactic Suburbia, Action Attraction, any one of the other ones. And if people want to make suggestions for podcasts, I'm always up for that. Go to paleo-cinema.com for the blog. Go to the Paleo Cinema Cafe on Facebook, or email me, or send a voicemail, or send an MP3 if you're inclined to cultguru, KULTGURU at gmail.com. Enjoy your movie watching over the next fortnight, and I'll be back then with more stuff. And I definitely recommend the two movies from this week. If you don't have them in your collection, get copies of them. Goodbye.
Ai serra nanni nemene sogliette, tu sai a to,
tu sai a to.
A to sto cor in grado ch'io dispiette, farmeno un po',
farmeno un po'.
A tu, il fuoco che c'è ma se fuio, te lascia sta.
Te lascia sta.
E non ti corre appresso e non distruia, vuoi solo guardare. Yam, yam, gappi, yam, mia. Yam, yam, gappi, yam, mia. Funiculi, funicula, funiculi, funicula. Gappi, yam, mia. Funiculi, funicula. Yam, yam, gap, yam, mia. Yam, yam, gap, yam, mia. Funiculi, funicula, funiculi, funicula. Gap, yam, mia. Funiculi, funicula.
Funiculi, 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 funiculi.
Neam dalla terra la montagna.
Lo basso c'è,
se vede frange proce della Spagna, io vengo a te,
io vengo a te.
Brave coli con nitte infatto, in cielo va,
ce lo si va.
Se va con malla viene dall'andrassata, qui se gli sa,
qui se gli sa.
Yam, yam, gap, yam, mia. Yam, yam, gap, yam, mia. Funiculi, funicula, funiculi, funicula. Gap, yam, mia. Funiculi, funicula.
Yam, yam, gap, yam, mia. Yam, yam, gap, yam, mia.
Funiculi, funicula, funiculi, funicula. Gap, eccoli, eccolo.